Institute for Personal Medical Advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, newsnetwork.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical...
KBOO Community Radio is hiring. We are seeking a full-time chief engineer. Applications are due by midnight on Monday, March 4th, to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214, or by emailing engineerhire@kboo.fm. To apply, please send both a resume and a cover letter outlining your skills and experience with regards to the minimum qualifications and by answering the following question: why is KBOO important? For more information and a full job description, go to kboo.fm/engineer2019. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. Again, for more information, go to kboo.fm/engineer2019.
You're listening to Voices for the Animals on your community radio, KBOO Portland.
The more compassion we have towards animals, the more compassion we're going to have towards other people.
If you can value them all, you really value yourself as well.
So even if you don't care about animals, the things we do that hurt animals end up hurting ourselves.
It's almost kind of a dominion type issue where we feel we need to control everything.
Dominion means stewardship, to take care of.
What would a cow think about satisfying our habit? The challenge lies with looking at suffering from the perspective of the person or individual suffering.
Welcome to Voices for the Animals. I'm Dab Stedman, your host, and my guest today is J.C. Reese, who is the Director of Research and co-founder of the Sentience Institute in New York City. He has lectured worldwide on the subject of effective animal advocacy and has written about it on many online sites, including the Huffington Post, Vox, and Salon. Our discussion today will focus on his new book, The End of Animal Farming: How Scientists, Entrepreneurs, and Activists Are Building an Animal-Free Food System. Welcome to the program, JC.
Hi there.
Yeah, so let's begin by hearing a little bit about the Sentience Institute, its purpose, and how your work there has informed you to write this book.
Sure. So my background is thinking about this big question called effective altruism. So basically, how can we do the most good with our time, with our money, with our resources? And this is a modern movement, you know, that emerged 5 or 10 years ago, but there have been people for many decades, I mean, throughout all of history, who didn't want to just do good in the world, but wanted to actually have the biggest impact they could. A lot of people are frustrated with, you know, whether it's corruption in nonprofits or not thinking their dollar is actually doing as much as it could, or not thinking that their career is, you know, having the impact on the world they dreamed of as a young person. So I was focused more on human issues for a while, you know, thinking about global poverty, public health, these things. But, you know, based on these arguments of doing the most good, these quantitative arguments, I really drifted towards the issue of animal farming. You know, there are just over 100 billion animals in the food system today. They suffer immensely on so-called factory farms. In fact, in the U.S., over 99% of farm animals live on factory farms, and globally that figure is over 90%. In addition to all the environmental, health, workers' rights, et cetera, issues, this seems like the most important issue for me to focus on. So Sentience Institute is generally working on the expansion of humanity's moral circle. You know, we envision a future where we consider the interests of all sentient beings. But right now, I think the most important frontier of the moral circle is farmed animals. So that's our current focus at Sentience Institute.
Yeah, definitely. Well, your book, as you just said, doesn't focus on the horrors of factory farming to make its case, but instead shares a vision of a brighter future for both man and beast. And you have actually created a roadmap to a fundamentally changed food production system, which is developing right here and now. Can you talk about the main thrust behind this transformation to a clean meat culture, maybe beginning with the latest advancements in technology that enable this?
Yes, of course. You know, you hit the nail on the head, and your program and other animal advocates have been laying the groundwork for kind of a big change in the global food system. there have been a lot of books so far, you know, addressing these problems, but not as many thinking about, okay, we have this public awareness, we have this momentum, people identify as animal lovers, they're now aware of a lot of the cruelty in factory farming. How do we actually change things? And that's what the book addresses. So right now you have a lot of momentum that's been generated from radio programs like this, from undercover investigations, and you're starting to see people want to change their behavior. You're starting to see institutions like companies and governments want to do things like adopt Meatless Mondays. And a big focus of the book, and I think a big thing we're seeing right now in 2018 and 2019, 2020, and in the next few years, is food technology. So you mentioned clean meat. So clean meat is real animal meat, animal flesh, made from animal cells, but without animal slaughter. So you take a small sample of cells from a living animal and grow them the same way they grow inside an animal's body, but you're doing this way the way you would brew cheese or the way you would brew beer. So it creates the same product, but without having to have animal farming or all these harmful ethical issues. We're going to see a continued social movement. So, of course, you're going to have policy and regulation, consumer advocacy, marketing, and all these things to get widespread adoption. But my best guess is that in that roadmap you mentioned, the cornerstone of change is going to be this food technology.
Yeah, it was pretty fascinating in your book. We went into quite a bit of detail about that. Well, can you tell us who are some of the major players involved in the development of plant-based protein foods, and what would you say motivates them to be pioneers in this burgeoning field?
Yeah, so first you have the companies like Tofurky, Follow Your Heart, these vegan, ethical, really mindful companies that have been around, some for decades, and have been providing, you know, hearty, satisfying, healthy, ethical, plant-based food for primarily vegans and vegetarians, but also, you know, reducitarians, people trying to cut down on their animal product consumption. But over the past decade or so, you've seen the emergence of some new players who are not just trying to provide a solid option for vegetarians, but who are trying to help these so-called latent omnivores. So people who are currently eating animal products, but they are aware of the ethical argument. They'd like to go vegetarian, but they're not currently willing to.
Are there any names that we would recognize as far as some of the major entrepreneurs who have jumped into this?
Yeah, so Ethan Brown and Pat Brown have founded two companies respectively called Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods. And they're the most famous because they've produced so-called bleeding veggie burgers. So these, to many people, are indistinguishable from animal-based beef. There's also a company called Just, formerly known as Hampton Creek, which is quite large and has been producing the most products so far in terms of eggless mayonnaise, in terms of eggless dressing and cookie dough, and it's currently making a foray into that clean meat technology that we discussed. And it could be the first company to bring that to market, actually in 2019, or at least within a couple of years. So those are some of the big players, but you're also starting to see big food companies and meat companies like Tyson Foods, you know, the world's second largest meat processor, or Cargill, a real food, you know, behemoth, start to invest in this technology and start to get involved, start to get their feet wet and follow the innovation of animal advocates and those smaller emerging companies.
Okay, besides the clean meat, which is made from actual animal cells, are there other types of alternative protein foods that the new technologies are able to create?
Yes, so the Beyond Burger and the Impossible Burger are both concoctions of plant ingredients, things like coconut oil or wheat protein or potato protein, that mimic the taste and the texture and the mouthfeel, you know, the bite and the chew of an animal-based beef burger or another animal product. In fact, the Impossible Burger has an ingredient called heme, which you might recognize from hemoglobin, so the constituent in animal blood that makes beef taste metallic or irony, that has an aftertaste to it. And they found that in soy, soy root nodules, actually, and are now producing it with microorganisms in an established food process that's the same way that insulin is made for diabetics these days, and rennet is actually made for cheese. And these products are really fantastic because they're much easier than that clean meat technology. You know, I think clean meat is something in the long run, but it's a long way to scale up that technology to grow those cells and all that. But we can definitely, you know, mix together plant ingredients right now. It's not that much harder than, you know, seitan or flavored tofu or something. And they're already starting to scale up. And right now the big challenge is just getting the economies of scale going and mass producing those products so they can get in McDonald's and Walmart, and they can start to be the default option instead of an animal product.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how the cost compares, because I know starting up, what was at that first, I call them faux hamburgers or whatever, what did that cost them to produce something like $100,000 or something like that? But is the technology at the point where you talk about scaling up where you can foresee that these products are going to be available at an affordable price for most people?
Yeah, so the famous figure is the world's first clean or cultured hamburger, you know, a real animal flesh burger, and that was about $300,000 per burger, so quite insane. But if you think about iPhones or something, you know, the research and development that went into the first product was, of course, huge, you know, often billions of dollars, or at least millions. So they're starting to scale up their factories, their production facilities. A lot of it is still projections. You know, these companies are not producing at nearly the scale of factory farming or of animal agriculture in general. So everyone's kind of speculating, but at least in theory, you know, if you're producing a food with plant ingredients, if you're not using an animal, I mean, animals are so inefficient. This is kind of one of the original arguments against animal farming, was that you feed so many calories of corn and of grain to farmed animals to get just a few calories of beef or pork or eggs or whatever you want. So based on that efficiency, you should be able to produce plant-based products for much lower costs. You know, I expect by 2050 or a few decades down the road, we'll have these sophisticated, you know, Beyond Burgers or Impossible Burgers that are actually much cheaper than their animal-based alternative.
Okay, and are these developments happening in places other than the United States, around the world?
They are. So the United States is special because it has Silicon Valley. So it's not as much because it's a high-income country, you know, there are lots of those, but really because we have this global incubator for new technologies. You know, I talk to entrepreneurs in other countries who feel they have to move to the United States to get a company going so they can talk to the venture capital and the angel investors in California. So you have a few places like Singapore or like the United Kingdom, so London, where you do have finance and investment hubs and you have some stuff getting going. That first clean hamburger was actually in the Netherlands. So you've got a nice community there of culture meat scientists. You know, some of them are working within academia to get the roots of this technology established. But I would expect East Asia and Singapore and even China, you know, them getting on board. There's currently a $300 million clean tech deal between Israel, which is one of the big hubs, and China. So investing in renewables and things like that. And you could see the emergence and a huge, you know, investment in these new products. So keep an eye there, but for now, most of it's in California, most of it's specifically in the Bay Area.
Yeah, well, no matter where you are, but particularly China, when you have a billion and a half mouths to feed and you're feeding them with an unsustainable food stores, I think in your book you said for every 10 calories that a cow or maybe a pig is fed, they only produce 1 calorie of edible meat product. So what, as they say, do the math, and this seems to be the way to go. Maybe not so much because people care about animals, but because it's the only way that all the human beings on this planet can be fed at a reasonable cost, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. You make a really good point in that even if people can't muster the moral motivation, you know, to adopt an animal rights ideology or to go vegan themselves, there are many self-interest reasons for this change to happen. I think that just kind of sheer efficiency argument is one of the biggest reasons to expect with a fair amount of confidence that animal farming will end by the end of this century.
Okay. At first, I was a little surprised to read in your book that you think the current way of encouraging people to adopt a vegan lifestyle, kind of on a one-on-one personal basis, has been largely ineffective, and that there's a much better way to affect people's eating habits. Can you share your research findings that led to this opinion and then suggest a more effective way to change our food choices?
Of course. So because of those arguments we discussed with the scale of animal farming and how new the movement is, I think any work in this area is really effective. You know, if you're going out and convincing your friends and family or people on the street to eat more plant-based foods in any way, you're doing a huge amount of good. But when we're making these really tough decisions of, you know, nonprofit budgets and using our very limited resources, I think we do really need to reach for the most effective strategies. And the biggest research finding of the book, of my research in my entire career, I think, has been that a focus on institutions is more effective than a focus on individuals. So, for example, getting a company or a government to adopt a new policy, such as Meatless Mondays, such as even a fully vegan or vegetarian policy, focusing on changing people collectively, you know, changing even nonprofits. So, for example, now that Greenpeace is setting a goal of reducing meat and dairy consumption globally by 50% by 2050, you know, that's really exciting and really powerful. And I think it's more effective than this one-by-one, you know, so-called go vegan approach that the movement has largely focused on.
Yeah, and you also, go ahead, yeah.
Oh, just a brief look at the evidence. So, you know, social movements very rarely use an individual approach and even more rarely succeed with it. So you've seen attempts in the anti-slavery movement a few centuries ago, in modern environmentalism, to focus a lot on one-by-one, you know, consumer change. And mostly those movements have seen that approach as ineffective and have shifted towards institutional strategies.
Yeah, and you also mention in your book quite a big emphasis on the use of social media to accomplish this end. Yeah,
so when we think about how people change, you know, people are very social creatures. I mean, we grew and evolved in societies, and that's how we make decisions. You know, think about how powerful peer pressure can be, whether it's a historical atrocity like the Holocaust or witch trials, you know, people just following the crowd, but also think of positive things like, you know, getting teenagers to avoid drugs or things like that. You know, a lot of that comes from role models who teach them to avoid crime and things like that. We're just hugely social creatures. And if people can change together, so for example, if you can have a viral social media video, you know, everyone's seeing that. They're having conversations about it with their friends, and that can be a lot more impactful than, you know, you're just walking down the street by yourself, get handed a leaflet, you glance at it, and then you throw it away and never talk about it again. If you can generate conversations, if you can build a community, if you can get people changing collectively, that's when you can, you know, solve these global food problems.
Yeah, so we all should be using that great tool. We're going to have to take a brief break now, so please stay tuned. We're back, and you're listening to Voices for the Animals on KBOO Portland. We're talking with J.C. Rees of the Sentient Institute about his book called The End of Animal Farming, which describes the transformational food movement happening today. Okay, J.C., we've just talked about two or three of the factors necessary to bring about the end of animal farming, namely advanced technology and interested entrepreneurs. So let's turn now to a third major aspect of your strategy, mainly the role of animal advocates in this plan. Based on your research of several other social movements, which you mentioned before, you have suggested a few general do's and don'ts for activists. Can you please share those pointers with us?
Yeah, so a big one is that focus on institutional change that we discussed, on collective action. Another one would be to avoid gimmicks. So one of the biggest controversies within the animal rights movement to date has been the use of, you know, throwing fake blood on people wearing fur, or disrupting speeches, or, you know, provocative tactics that generate a lot of attention but might come at the cost of reputation. So, of course, PETA has been one of the big groups using this tactic. And overall, I think that the cost of this have outweighed the benefits. And when it comes to things like sex sells, you know, using nudity, you know, scantily clad images of women, that tends to be counterproductive. And while it gets a lot of eyeballs and gets a lot of news stories, I think in general what we struggle with right now as an animal rights movement is improving the reputation, getting us taken seriously, getting institutions to change, getting people to kind of respect this movement and think of it the way we think of human rights movements. So I'd encourage people to avoid those gimmicks.
Yeah, and you also mentioned using stories about individual animals to arouse compassion and moral outrage.
Exactly. So, well, a big takeaway from social psychology is how motivated people are by individuals. You know, think of the crowdfunding campaigns for, you know, a child who fell down a well or suffering from some rare disease. Those raise so much money so quickly, whereas we can get, you know, very limited amounts for these masses farmed animals and even masses of, you know, human children in the developing world, for example. So I'd encourage people to focus on those stories, but then draw out the issue using statistics and using facts to explain how big the issue is. But start with those stories.
Okay.
Another one would be focusing on how people can change. So if you are trying to get, you know, people around you to eat more plant-based foods, very often today, and this is, you know, to the credit of the movement so far, they're aware of the problems and they see vegetarianism as a moral ideal. And they'd love to do it, but they think it's not possible for them. You know, it's so common these days to say, oh, well, yes, I've seen that cruelty, but, you know, I'm an athlete, so I need my protein, or, you know, it's natural, or these things. And if you can show people, you know, how they can eat, for example, protein-rich plant-based foods like, you know, beans or grains that are rich in protein, but also these new products, the veg meats or the plant-based meats, so to speak, that can encourage them to move along. And I think that's what we need right now. A lot of this discussion has to do with what the current bottlenecks are or what the current neglected approaches are within the animal movement.
Yeah, and in your book you indicated that it's easier to get the big food giants to switch their production from animal to plant-based products than it would be to shut them down entirely. Do you have reason, or is there reason to believe that this switch is seriously being discussed in corporate boardrooms today?
Yes, I think so. So there's a lot of hesitation around big companies. You know, a lot of people are concerned with the current practices of capitalism in America and other countries, and maybe these companies are just, I don't know, trying to talk the ethics, you know, talk the talk, get consumers on board, go, you know, look like a green company, but aren't actually going to follow it up with their money, with their investments, with their business choices. But they are starting to invest. I mean, this is still a very early stage, so not much is happening right now. But companies like Tyson, like Cargill, the big grocery chains, you know, like Walmart, are starting to carry more plant-based foods. So I'm cautiously optimistic. You know, I think we need to look out for something. So at Sentience Institute, for example, we did a lot of research into the genetically modified foods industry to see kind of how that went wrong, in the sense that a lot of scientists thought, you know, genetically modified foods could solve a lot of the world's pressing issues, and it was a very powerful technology. But then, you know, companies like Monsanto picked up genetically modified crops and started doing some, you know, ethically dubious things with it, and really put the public off. And we saw a lot of consumer rejection and policy and institutional rejection of genetically modified foods. And one takeaway from this might be that we want to ensure the ethical outlook of these companies. You know, right now, the people founding these new companies like Beyond Meat or Impossible Foods are advocates. They're environmentalists. They're animal rights advocates. They're vegetarians, you know, who would love to see positive change in the food system. And while it's a huge power to work with companies like Tyson and Cargill, they need to be cautious. You know, move slowly. Don't get acquired too quickly. Don't take too much investment right now, and make sure that you're tackling these food issues while utilizing the resources and getting a best of both worlds scenario with these food giants.
Yeah, well, to substantiate what you're saying, about a year ago, an article was published by Forbes, and the name of the article said it was Why You Should Turn Your Business Vegan in 2018. So that speaks volumes right there, I think. Let me go on. One ironic point raised in your book is that although animal rights activists play an important role in bringing about the end of animal agriculture, this new generation of food products is not being created with vegans and vegetarians in mind. So just who are the marketing targets for these newer alternative protein foods?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, if you're already consuming a whole foods, plant-based diet, that is fantastic. Please, you do not need to be consuming these new products. These are for people who are, you know, latent omnivores. They want to change. They're aware of the problems, whether it's, you know, for their own self-interest, their health, or for, you know, moral reasons or something. They just need a product that can help bridge the gap between their behavior and their values. And that's what these products are providing. So, you know, over 70 or 80% of the consumption of these products of these new companies is coming from omnivores. And they're selling out of grocery stores. And that's not something we've really seen much as, you know, a vegan community or as an animal rights community. So far, it's been fairly insular. And, you know, you go to the vegan part of the grocery store, and if you make that deliberate decision, you're a very unique consumer. You know, not many people are willing to go to a specific section of a grocery store to do their shopping. But now you have plant-based milks, for example. You know, the biggest progress so far has been in that sector, where they're right next to the dairy-based milks in the grocery store. And that's why you've seen such a big spike. They're now around 10% market share of animal-based.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
Exactly, and you're starting to see that for the meat products. So right now, the figure people usually give is 0.25%. That's how big the product is for, the market is for plant-based meat compared to animal-based meat as a whole. But now that Beyond Meat is in the meat aisle, you know, it's packaged in a similar way, you're seeing consumers who see it right next to the product they would choose and are instead switching for that plant-based option because they're not willing to go to that specific section of the grocery store, but they're willing enough to, you know, pick the product on their right instead of the product on their left, and that's the bulk of consumers.
Yeah, things are definitely moving in a positive direction. You do say, however, in your book, you talk about the 4N reasons why people still eat meat. And so I'm wondering if you could just mention those briefly and then answer the question, will the public be willing to swallow this big change?
Sure. So normal, you know, eating meat is something people have always done and everyone around them does. Natural is something humans have done for a long time. It fits with human biology. It's nice, so it just quite simply, you know, tastes good. And that it's necessary. You know, it's important for our health, whether that's protein or B12 or another nutrient, or just a vague sense that we need it for our health. And these are all, you know, roadblocks that people have encountered. You know, if you've had a conversation with somebody about vegetarianism, you might have, you know, went to those yourself when you've considered eating more plant-based foods. And each of them can be targeted in specific ways. So for example, I think normal is a really big one. And talking about how many people are eating these new products and getting people in individual social circles is a big way to change, because as we discussed before, humans are social creatures. I think that consumers are starting to swallow this change. I'm not as optimistic as some people. You know, I don't think everyone's going to go vegan overnight or even over the next couple of years. I don't think you're going to see, for example, this tipping point that people talk about, where once 10% of the population goes vegan, everyone else very quickly follows. However, I am optimistic over the period of decades. So once you have this technology, once you have this policy change, once you have Meatless Mondays, once you, for example, you know, the consequences of climate change get more real to people, once we have increasing temperatures and natural disasters, and that really ramps up, a lot of people will change just out of their own self-interest. I'm optimistic that we're going to, you know, fix our issues, but I think it might happen, you know, 2030, 2040, and I'm confident it'll happen by the end of this century.
Well, that sounds good to me. We just have a minute or two left, so specifically, could you give some ideas to our activist listeners how they can help expedite this much-hoped-for end of animal farming?
Of course. So the two easiest things are, first, to help out with these campaigns. So like we said, changing institutions. So, for example, the Humane League is a great organization that has a network called the Fast Action Network. And if you look that up online, you'll see ways to micro-volunteer and, you know, call a company asking them to serve cage-free eggs or more plant-based options or, you know, even the Beyond Burger or something like that. Mercy for Animals has a similar program called Hen Heroes. And then also to form communities, so to have meetups, to encourage people around you to change. If you're at a workplace that has its own cafeteria, you know, get that cafeteria to have more plant-based options. You know, companies will listen to their employees. They have to. It's their bottom line. And wherever, you know, whichever institutions and communities you have leverage at, again, utilize that social pressure to really affect change.
Okay, great. Just very, very briefly, can you give us the contact information for the Sentient Institute? And we will post this on our program page.
Of course, we're at sentienceinstitute.org. We're also on social media, Sentience Institute. And people can find the book on Amazon, or you can support your local bookstore, and you should be able to find it just about anywhere.
Oh, super, super. Well, our time is up now, so thank you very much, J.C. Reese, for sharing with us the practical and inspirational ideas in your book, The End to Animal Farming.
Thanks, Deb.
Okay, and thanks to all of our listeners, too. If you've missed an episode of Voices for the Animals, podcasts of all our programs are available on the station's website at kboo.fm. And please plan to tune in again on the fourth Monday of next month. Until then, remember that you, too, can be a voice for the animals. KBOO Portland.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meetings policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee meets the fourth Monday of every month at 4:30 p.m.
KBOO Portland.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meetings policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee meets the fourth Monday of every month at 4:30 p.m.
Well, a pleasant good afternoon to you. This is Noontime Jamboree, and that's Moggy over there.
And that's Henry over there.
And we're here until 2 p.m. The Hawk is away, so we'll try and fill in for him. Anyway, stay tuned. Thank you.